We are ready to begin to hear our presentations. We are first going to hear from Howard Garrett, who flew down from Whidbey Island and rented a car and made his way through the infernos and herds of deer crossing Highway 101 and barely got here, but he did, without his hair on fire. Thank you for making that trip. Thank you so much. I cannot even begin to thank you for all of the whale research and observation and work and love and time that you have put in to the ocean and to the planet. Since 1981, is that right? Or earlier than that? Anyway, he and his wife Susan founded Orca Network in 2001. They are dedicated to raising the awareness of whales of the Pacific Northwest and the importance of providing them healthy and safe habitats. He gives presentations on orca natural history, conservation, captivity issues in Washington and beyond. And I know you work with a lot of fellow scientists up there that we know and love. He has been interviewed for stories about orcas, including the film Blackfish, that some of you may have seen. And his focus is on the southern resident orcas, right, of the Salish Sea and coastal waters, now down to only 73 members.
Thank you all for being here, and thank you to the organizers, to Scott and Tree and Tai and Andy and everybody. We put on events kind of like this, and I know what it takes, a lot of meetings, a lot of phone calls to line everything up, so I very much appreciate the opportunity and everyone being here. So I'm going to launch right in. I've got a lot to cover here in a little while, so what I want to start with is this graphic. I love this graphic. I think it's incredible. It shows so much. It's by a dear friend of ours, Sue Cochia. You can find her work in airports and shops all over. And she is a big devotee of orcas and doing whatever is necessary. And this graphic shows so much because, of course, it's the orca and Free the Snake, which is the topic that I'm going to cover in this talk. And I'll explain what that is. As a standalone slogan, it can be misunderstood, but it has a great meaning. But all the other critters depend on what the snake produces, what it provides, which are primarily the salmon, the fish. But also, this guy here kind of is what I feel like when I keep hearing they won't restore that river. They need to right away. So, okay. Let's get right to why we're doing it. This was the tour of grief that shook up the world. Probably many of you, it was a year ago, last August and September, that J-35 Talequa gave birth, and within a half hour, that baby died. And she carried her deceased infant around for 17 days. 17 days of intense attention. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation. Did she intend that to be a message? I don't, you know, can't confirm. But it sure was one. It went around the world. It reverberated everywhere. These whales are in deep trouble. They're dying young. They're dying even before birth. It's terrible. So she really brought the attention where it needed to be. And that was followed within weeks by the death of J-50 Scarlet, also followed by media attention around the world. It was amazing. They were the best awareness raisers. I mean, you know, that we don't want any whale to sacrifice to carry a message, but that's what they did. She was much beloved. And what I want to try to, you know, impress upon you is that we know these whales up there in orca country, maybe down here too. And by the way, you know, those whales often come right by here. L-pod, K-pod, some of the southern resident orcas of Washington State travel right past California down to Monterey, in fact, in search of food. So they are much beloved up there. We know them from birth. We know their stories. And we grieve when they die. This was just one friend who is an artist and a naturalist and who drew this graphic to show her feelings, her memorial to J50. She was so acrobatic, so friendly, so curious, and she died at less than 4 years old. So this is the numbers. I mean, there's a whole lot of emotion involved in this, but there's also the straight numerical demographics. They were at 74. This is from the Center for Whale Research as of last July 1st. They were at 74. They are now at 73, as Taiyi mentioned. It's a drastic decline, and it is compounded by the reproductive failures, the inability to bring about the new generations. And it's been studied from many different angles. Many, many scientists are trying to figure this out. And this is one, it's called photogrammetry. And it's a way of looking from overhead. It was originally done with helicopters, and then drones came along. So now it's done by drone to take a look at how they look from above. And a lot can be measured, can be understood from an overhead shot. And this sort of helps to show some of what has been learned. Two-thirds of pregnancies end in miscarriage. And they don't see the pregnancies until they're about halfway through the 17-month gestation. But two-thirds of those that they see, females that are pregnant, never give birth. And this is another graphic illustration. This is September 2015, J17, Princess Angeline, looking nice and plump. But by September 2018, you can see the distinct difference. She's got skinny, turned very skinny. And then in May 2019, even skinnier, and then disappeared just last August. She was a grandmother, a mother of four. One had died, but three other still living offspring, and now they don't have their mother. And that is way premature. Their lifespans are very much like human lifespans. You can easily just compare that way. So that's a 42-year-old female, still very vibrant, very much a vital member of her society, just at the upper end of her reproductive years. But the thing about orcas, and I'm going to bring this out in the afternoon talk more, is that they are the only other animal besides humans where females have a long menopause, which means a long post-reproductive lifespan. So in other words, she was just entering that elder female phase of her life where they impart their ways, their traditions, and teach the young. And she passed away. And this is another way of finding all that out. This is Tucker, the original poop-sniffing dog. And now there's a new one. I hope I'll have time for the video at the end to show you the... This has been going on for several years, and now there are new generations of poop-sniffing dogs. But so much can be found out. The ID of the whales, this, you know, the poop-sniffing dog can sniff some fecal matter from a quarter mile to a half mile away, depending on the breeze. Then the researchers come up with a fine mesh net and scoop it up, analyze it. And they get all kinds of information, reproductive status, host and prey DNA, nutritional status, stress hormones, pathogens, toxins levels, diseases and pathogens. And all of that is extremely valuable and has shown this kind of information. Again, 69% of all pregnancies fail before birth. Low availability of Chinook is endangering the habitat. That's probably the fundamental take-home message, is that they're lacking in sufficient diet, in enough Chinook. And I'm going to explain a little more this afternoon about why they depend almost entirely on Chinook, one of the five species of salmon. Nothing but the biggest and the finest, of course, but they have traditionally over hundreds of thousands of years, possibly, depended on Chinook salmon for their sustenance, for their survival. And those are in dire straits, and that's where I'm going with this talk. So it's the Columbia Snake River and the Fraser River runs, that's up in Canada by Vancouver, that supply most, that are the big producers, or historically have been the big producers of Chinook. And the conclusion is it's all about the fish. And the lead researcher, Sam Wasser, said, we've got to look at the Snake River. What is that impact? This is sort of the standard pie chart that shows the percentages. Chinook, salmon, 82% of their diet. They will have a side dish of other species of salmon, and occasionally a steelhead. And there's even been, you know, other species very rarely that are found in their scale samples or fecal matter, but 82% Chinook, almost entirely. And this is just to sort of give you an indication of why we know they depend on those Columbia River, Snake River, Chinook. For most of every year, nobody sees these whales. This was done by satellite tagging, which is a terrible thing. I love the data, but I hate the method, to put the satellite tag in with hooked barbs into their flesh. It ended when one died of that in 2016. So that's on hold now. But the data show, and this is just typical, this is just one day of one whale of the eight that were tagged. So, but it is representative of what most of the satellite tag tracks showed, which is they hover right around the mouth of the Columbia, right where those Chinook, after 2, 3, 4 years out at sea, growing big and fat, are finally headed back in, and they get to the mouth of the Columbia River, and that's where the southern resident orcas hang out. They're there to feast on them. That's their main mother load of food. So, every indication is they depend on those salmon. Just want to establish that for sure. And where do those salmon come from? Here, 5,500 miles of pristine, roadless, primitive wilderness area. There is still that much left in the United States in central and southern Idaho. And it is an amazing, just a wonderland, a cornucopia of life that is deprived of its lifeblood because of these dams. And this sort of gives you a sense of, this is that wilderness area in Idaho. This is the Snake River, which is the primary tributary into the Columbia River. The Columbia River has its own dams, but it is these four higher elevation Snake River dams that are the death knell that are killing the salmon. But you can see it's a direct lifeline straight to the ocean, and out here is where the orcas are waiting for their food. And this is what it used to be like. Big old fish, gigantic salmon. They were called June hogs because they were the high altitude Chinook that would go into the 5,000 feet of elevation up to where they found the spawning streams. And they got really, really big. They don't get like that anymore. You don't find them. If you can find a 50 or 60 pound Chinook, you've pretty well got a record anymore. So they just don't come out like that anymore because for many different reasons, but they're very few and they're much smaller. And it looks really bad for this year too. There's been a bad streak. There used to be well over a million, uncounted, nobody really knew, but well over a million, and now we're talking maybe 48,000, and 80% of those are hatchery fish, which are weaker and smaller than native fish. So it's much more work to catch enough to get the caloric intake to survive. So a lot more work for smaller fish. And as Ken Balcom, who is the founder director of the Center for Whale Research, who's been conducting the population survey since 1976, and when we get to the video, you'll see he still gets out on the water. And his assessment, looking at the reproductive failures and the whole population trend, is that they're not going to survive if we can't bring them more salmon in short order. And this is sort of the graph that is the University of Washington Columbia Basin chart that shows the smolt to adult return, which is the best way to measure the ability of the fish to survive, to maintain their numbers at all. And to really recover in any kind of healthy way, you have to have at least 4% of all those fish that go out into the ocean to get back up into the spawning beds to be able to reproduce the next generation. And at 2%, there may be stability. It's very much iffy at that point. At 1%, they're headed toward extinction, and look at that. I mean, they're down to almost 0% of the smolt to adult ratio. So here's why. It's these dams. There are four of these dams. And this is actually a artist's illustration of how to breach them. And it's really easy. I mean, you know, I don't really need to oversimplify the case because the Army Corps of Engineers does. This is the page out of a 2002 environmental impact statement published by the Army Corps of Engineers, which is who built and who owns and operates all those dams and who has the authority right now to unilaterally to issue a record of decision, it's called, to declare the dams non-operational, which is lingo for useless, not producing anything of value, and to bring them down. And all they have to do is push down the earthen berms. Unlike most dam removals, you don't have to blow up concrete. It's really not too expensive at all. I mean, you have to do some other mitigations and preparations to do it, you know, shore up some embankments and do some preparations, get all the boats that are upstream, downstream, if they need the locks to go down. So, you know, a couple of months of preparations and to, you know, modernize some of the aspects of the study. But then you go in with the earth-moving equipment and you just dig a notch in that earthen berm. It may have pavement on top, that's easy, but you dig a notch on that earthen berm and then you let the water level rise and start to flow through the earth, and it will gradually cut its own channel and you'll have a free-flowing river once again, just like in the Army Corps' own illustration. It's really a no-brainer. It's and not horrifically expensive. The best estimates by economists today is that the entire process would cost about $400 million, which may seem like a lot, but much more than that is being wasted to keep the dams in place every year. Federal appropriations are coming into the region to operate and maintain the dams and to mitigate, as required by the ESA, to try every conceivable way. Amazing hardware has been designed and barging of smolts and every other way to try to help the salmon survive the dams. And five court federal district court decisions over 20 years have declared it ain't working, go back to the drawing boards, what you're doing is not working, you have to start talking about the dams. And by the way, just the mention of the Fraser River up at Vancouver as the other source is also in trouble. So we need to do everything possible to get more salmon to these whales. And this is just to show you that we will sacrifice our dignity rather than sacrifice our southern resident orcas. That's Ken Balcom. That's a retired Army Corps of Engineers civil engineer who has been a great whistleblower, inside source for amazing information on the economics and the politics of the Snake River dams. And that's me in the full-body orca suit over there. So, you know, we'll do anything. That was when President Obama came to Seattle, and he and Governor Inslee gave a big event. And so, yeah, we're yelling at him. We've tried every other way. Full-page ads in the Seattle Times. This has been going on for 4 years. Since we have really upped the ante and the level, the amplitude of our campaign to try to bring down the dams. There's a small core of us that have been working on these issues for a long time. We're trying to make it clear to them. Ken also does the more distinguished thing, as we all have, of giving presentations to try to spell out the case and make it all as clear as possible. And partly, hopefully, maybe as a result of that, Governor Inslee, in March of 2018, actually declared an emergency and an executive order. We've got to restore the rivers, restore the food source, really, he was nonspecific. He was a little more ambiguous, I have to say. We got to help the orcas. It's called the Orca Recovery Act. And that created the Orca Recovery Task Force, which was almost 50 representatives of the agencies, meaning the Army Corps, the Bonneville Power Authority, which is who markets all of that power and sort of oversees the financial end of it. And NOAA, which writes up the biological opinions, which are the basis upon which they make those decisions, whether to keep the dams or not, and they all say, we can keep the dams. They all seem to agree on that, and they were the members of the task force whose mandate was to figure out how to save the whales, and they've got heavy investments in many ways in keeping the dam. So it was doomed from the start. I think of it now, and this is after 2 years of meetings of all of these people, not just agency people, a lot of industry people, a lot of regional politicians, a lot of other people who basically know very little about orcas or biology in general, but they have their own interests, their own groups, their own constituents that they have to speak for. And of course, they don't want to sacrifice anything. So, you know, the orcas are not that important in relation to where they're all coming from. So it was really doomed from the start. And in fact, in the beginning of it, they didn't even want to talk about the dams, even though 5 federal judges had said, you've got to start talking about the dams over 20 years. They started the task force without even any mention of breaching the dams. So there was a huge public upwelling of demand. We've got to start talking about the dams. And finally, in midstream in August, while J-35 was carrying her dead calf around, the governor asked the task force to consider breaching the dams. Put it on the table at least, please. So they did, and that formed this Snake River Task Force group, breakout group, to talk about the dams. And so they met off to the side, And they came up with these questions. That's where they left it. And we've answered all those questions. We were in the room, but we were not allowed to speak. But we could have answered all those questions for them right there with documentation. And yet they just wanted to ask a few more questions and then put it back on the table and walk away. And that's basically what they did. The task force made a lot of recommendations. In fact, they're just about to make their final recommendations in November. And I've sort of come to think of it as the Everything But Orca Recovery Task Force. There's a lot of restoration in Puget Sound and a lot of, you know, climate change recommendations and they focus on the boats, as being the big problem, and it's really not. It's about diet. It's about sufficient food. They want to, cull the pinnipeds, take out the seals and sea lions, and that's a peripheral issue, and it, is fraught with all sorts of other problems, including depriving the other type of orcas, which is a whole matter that I'll be getting into this afternoon. The mammal-eating transient orcas depend upon those pinnipeds. Anyway, they did a lot of things that are irrelevant to saving the orcas, and they did not address the real issue, which is how to bring about the most salmon in the shortest time, and that can only be by breaching the dams. And this is part of why. This is just a representative of the backlash, of the ingrained, deeply funded and organized opposition to breaching the dams ever, and including, U.S. representatives and chambers of commerce and public utility districts and port authorities, and they're all organized along with, of course, editorial boards of newspapers, and they said taking down the dams is a waste of taxpayer money, even talking about it. To which we respond, what? Really? I'm assuming that's what the orcas say about that. So this is a columnist in Seattle who said the Snake River Dam's battle has lasted longer than the 30 years war. It just goes on and on. And what they have all sort of been pointing to for the last several years has been this new EIS process that is due to announce something in the spring about what they're going to do about the whole Columbia Basin. All, I believe it's 18 dams, and sort of they've mixed the Snake River in with all of that, so it's going to be very vague and ambiguous. So people have been hoping that in that process, somehow somebody in there will say, well, maybe we ought to breach the dams, that NOAA would come up with a biological opinion that would indicate that they should breach the dams to provide more fish to save the orcas. That is not going to happen. There's been enough indications now that they will just sidestep that whole question and come up with, I don't know what it'll be, but it'll be irrelevant to saving fish or orcas. And these are some of the best, by the way. I mean, this is not just one run of Chinook salmon that we're talking about. These are the last remaining high altitude, big Chinook salmon in the lower 48 and equivalent to anything in Alaska. And of course, they're continuing to die. This was J17, who was in the previous slide, but who was declared missing August of 2019, and two others. So, they're going away. And it's really hard to take when there is a solution. So I'm gonna show you how to get that solution done. There are two congressmen, two U.S. representatives that are very key to getting it done. We need more, but you got to start somewhere. And this is a true red conservative Republican in Idaho who loves fish and who cares about the fact that the fish are disappearing too fast. So he has come out and said, we've got to talk about the dams. And he announced at a big conference in Boise last April and just completely paralyzed the House. They were riveted to what he was saying because he kept talking about what we need to do to breach the dams. He didn't quite take it over the top and say, I recommend breaching the dams. He just says, we've got to look at all these parameters, and everything that he looked at, you know, indicated we've got to breach the dams. So he's very close, but he stands alone. And he's getting a lot of backlash from a lot of quarters, all across the spectrum. So he needs support. We need to send him some support. But more locally is your own congressman, Jared Huffman. Now, I haven't seen any commitment from him, confirmation that he is in favor of breaching the dams. But I do know that he is very well informed on the dams, in part because our friend Scott Mercer sent him a letter, I suggested, that he answered. First, it was with his assistants, but I've actually, heard from him that he wants more information. He's very interested in this topic. He knows everything that I've been talking about. He has the real information, the real facts. And this is how you can get in touch with him. And he could be very, very valuable. And this is a brochure that I have out on the table out there, and I hope everyone will take a look at it and read it, and please take it home with you. Take a few more if you've got friends or family that might be interested. I don't want to take them back. So please take one if you can. So please get in touch with Congressman Huffman. Give him your love. I think he's a fantastic guy. Yes, question? He'll be in Fort Bragg on Saturday, November 9th.
At Dana Gray.
At Dana Gray? Okay. Oh, elementary school. Okay. All right. Well, you can talk to him there. And just say you've heard all about the starving orcas, the need to breach the Snake River dams, and please do everything you possibly can. What I am very embarrassed to say is that there is not one Washington political elected official who will support breaching the dams at this point. That backlash, that pro-dam lobby contingent, so well-funded, so systematic, so entrenched, and with a long history of misleading the public since before the dams were built, just to get them built on false promises, is still very active, and so is harsh, will punish any politician that wants to advocate breaching. So that's our job, is to get a Washington representative to support breaching up there.
I'm sure it will.
That is exactly right. There are many good examples of the success of breaching dams for bringing back, a whole wilderness. I mean, as that first graphic I showed illustrates, it's not just orcas, it's not just salmon. It's a whole, in fact, by one study, 137 species of mammals and birds and amphibians and reptiles that depend on those salmon reaching the high country. And that's what happens when those dams are breached. They bring the ocean nutrients up into the forest, and you find the signals from the ocean in the trees, in the plant life up there. So, I mean, it completely supports the entire wilderness ecosystem. And just to show you why we still have hope, here is one of the two new babies that was born in 2019. This is 3-month-old J56.
seen first in August of this year off the town of Tofino, and hence has been given the name Tofino. So with that, thank you very much for listening.